Welcome to Healthy Brain, Happy Body, a podcast from the Northeast Region Biofeedback Society. I'm Dr. Saul Rosenthal, a health psychologist in the Boston area, and your host as we investigate the incredible connections between brain and body. Welcome, everyone. We are talking with some of the presenters that will be at this year's NRBS conference at the end of September. And today we are joined by Dr. Donald Moss, psychologist, educator, and really one of the most influential voices in biofeedback and applied psychophysiology. And Don has authored hundreds of publications. He's edited numerous books and really has spent decades helping to shape the science and the practice of mind-body health. And he's also been a guest on Healthy Brain, Happy Body in the past, and it's always a pleasure to have him here. Now, at this year's NRBS conference, he's going to be speaking about our relationship with nature. And so in today's episode, we'll talk about his talk, which is titled Nature Contact and Its Effects on Stress, Resilience, and Health. Don, welcome back to Healthy Brain, Happy Body.
Thank you, Saul, and it's good to be here. And I'm happy to help promote the NRBS program.
Well, we're virtual this year, so we're hoping to get people from all over the world joining us. So when people hear the term stress management, you know, they tend to think about meditation, exercise, biofeedback, the sorts of things we do clinically in the office, not trees and plants. How did you become interested in spending time in nature as a health intervention?
Well, I was thinking about this, and as you know, I've written a number of books with the word pathways in the title, Pathways to Illness, looking at how lifestyle contributes to illness. And the second half of that title was Pathways to Health, the effect that we can use lifestyle to become healthy again. Well, I was gifted with a childhood in nature. I lived adjacent to a forest and wandered the forest in my free time, alone and with friends. I was a Boy Scout, Cub Scout and a Boy Scout, and went camping, and I camped with my family, and I walked the beaches and walked the forests. And it was just a taken for granted part of my life. Now, as an adult, I, through roundabout ways, became a clinical psychologist and had a clinical practice for about 40 years, most of it in West Michigan. And I was struck by the fact that I live in one of the most beautiful areas of the world. I personally live on a sand dune in a forest across the street from Lake Michigan. And yet many of my depressed patients not only weren't going regularly to any of that beautiful nature, but some of them had never actually seen Lake Michigan. They were sitting indoors in their home. The most depressed were often staring at the floor, sometimes with the lights off and the shades down. And it was true that some of them had never crossed the little bridge from their community to one of the state parks available on the Lake Michigan shore. And that struck me at the time. Later on, I was really privileged. I had two different practice locations which were in nature. I had I supervised Muskegon General Hospital outpatient stress management clinic for a while, and it happened that we rented space in a small, what had been a house, converted house became an office building, adjacent to a horse farm. And I started to find that if I would take my adolescent clients out and sit on the fence adjacent to the horses, something better happened often in the therapy. Of course, it wasn't magic, forming a relationship with an adolescent and inviting them to share their themselves, let alone their conflicts, is not easy. But being out there in a pasture adjacent to these beautiful animals seemed to help. Then I had a private practice going on along the Pigeon River. It's an area where this river that winds through wetlands comes out to Lake Michigan, and there's an inlet from Lake Michigan with a small harbor. And I was renting space in an office building with a larger practice, and would come down to the seawall and talk with my patients, adolescents and adults as well, and I often found that nature was beneficial. So this was in the background for me. Then around 2010, Angele McGrady and I started our work publishing research on lifestyle and well-being. Mm-hmm. We published a series of technical books and then more recently a book for lay people on lifestyle medicine, basically, and we had a particular approach to it called the Pathways Model. But what we were promoting with people is that biofeedback is very powerful, neurofeedback is powerful, hypnosis is powerful. With each of these interventions, people come to our office and often we're able to help them to moderate their symptoms, recover some state of well-being, sometimes very high levels of well-being. And yet these same patients show up again a year later, 2 years later, with many of the same symptoms all over again. And sometimes they've tried their self-regulation skills, their mind-body self-practices, and sometimes that's enough, but they come back just to refresh their skills. But oftentimes their lifestyle, as it is driving the same symptoms all over again, creating states of illness, sometimes serious illness. People who seem to be in remission are no longer in remission. So Angele and I began to really emphasize that along with our mind-body skills in our clinical practices, we have to start asking the lifestyle questions. And somewhere in that first decade of doing that, I started looking at nature contact as one of the elements in lifestyle. It happened, my university was collaborating with a university in Krems, Austria, IMC Krems University. And I was in Krems, and it just happened that the International Congress on Forest and its Potential for Health was holding it one of its early meetings at that university while I was there, so I attended. And this really got my attention because there were researchers coming in from Asia. Japan and China had really moved ahead faster than the West. Mm-hmm. But there were also researchers from all over Europe and some Americans. Presenting research showing that when we spend time in nature, it actually makes a difference. It makes a difference in our positive mood, increasing positive mood, decreasing negative mood, decreasing anxiety, decreasing depression. It makes a difference in blood pressure. It makes a difference in automatic nervous system activity. Just this morning, I was reading an article from University in Slovakia, Bratislava, Slovakia, on nature contact showing that it increases heart rate variability. Mm-hmm. So one of my pet interests, heart rate variability is something we do train in biofeedback, but it's also a very strong marker for well-being. So when we spend time in nature, especially if we open ourselves to the impact of that natural setting, it has an impact on our body and our mind. So that's my interest. That's a long answer, but that's how I got into this.
So is nature's contact with nature self-regulating in the same way that, say, paced breathing is, biofeedback, or is there some other mechanism?
Well, I think that there are several key theories, and I'll talk about them in my talk for NRBS. Mm-hmm. Theories about our evolution and the fact that our species evolved in a close harmony with nature for thousands of years, and that close engagement with nature has been severely disrupted in the modern era. As people moved first into towns and now into cities, there is an estrangement from nature. Mm-hmm. It's more complete for some than others. People in the inner city often have what we call a nature desert, just like they have a food desert. They don't have good access to healthy nutrition. They also have very little access to nature. Now, there are movements to counter that. I was in downtown Tokyo, and I was shocked to stumble into an alley which was completely natural, right in the middle of all these skyscrapers, mm-hmm. with benches so that people could go in and have their lunch or take their break from their work in a very natural setting. And the people are working hard on greening the urban environment. But nevertheless, the general trend is toward an estrangement from nature. And the theory is that this has a negative effect, psychological and physiological. Now, there's also the phytoncides in a forest. These are compounds that are emitted in a natural setting that do have a direct biochemical effect on us. So that is something that we pay attention to and realize, okay, it's really the phytoncides, which are organic compounds. They stimulate the parasympathetic nervous system, they boost immune function, they lower physiological stress levels, they enhance well-being, and they improve sleep. Mm-hmm. The research on this has gotten more and more extensive, and there are now meta-analyses available showing a number of, there's been weak studies on health, nature and health.
Sure.
But the studies are getting better, and the meta-analyses are saying, yes, we can actually rely on this. This is a direct effect. So when I'm in the forest, these phytoncides are impacting my physiology.
Hmm. So, the physiologic impact on heart rate variability, you said there was a study you're reading this morning. It sounds like, like immune response. And one thing that struck me as I've done a little bit of reading in this area is how little time it takes to have that effect.
Yeah.
So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that. Because, of course, we always think of self-regulation, 20 minutes twice a day of paced breathing kind of thing.
Well, and it's really quite similar. A lot of people think, I'm going to go to nature, so they go to an expensive nature spa. And I visited some nature spas in Europe and in the United States, and they're wonderful. But going once a year or once every 6 months is not enough. It's much better to have contact several times a week with nature. Mm-hmm. One of the studies said that if we have at least 10 minutes of nature exposure, you can see a difference in salivary cortisol. Mm. Those with 20 to 30 minutes of contact, you have more effect. If you end up with 120 minutes a week of nature contact, you're going to show significant measurable health benefits. So that's a relatively small change in lifestyle. I talked with a friend of mine who heard me give this talk at BFE, and he came home and he started taking 15 to 20 minutes after teaching class, walking in a natural area near his home, near the campus, and he feels a benefit.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's measuring his physiology in a number of ways because he's a biofeedbacker,
right.
But he feels a benefit when he does this for himself. And I know that for me, I'm a gardener.
Mm.
When I'm out with my hands in the dirt, pulling weeds, propping up plants, planting, just spending time there, smelling the dirt, surrounded by nature in my own yard, my own garden, or I work in a couple of community gardens. It's my therapy.
Mm-hmm.
I do meditate as well, and that has a different effect. I don't always get into a very quiet state when I'm gardening because sometimes I'm working very hard. It is aerobic, but I think it's beneficial for me that it's aerobic in the garden and not running on an urban street.
Mm, mm-hmm.
In fact, there's some studies comparing. You can do the same exercise. You can run in a city on the urban street or you can run in the forest, and there's benefit from both, of course. It's always good to but the benefits physiologically are better in the natural setting.
So how can we, as healthcare providers, integrate this? I mean, you've talked about how you would meet your clients outside, and I think there's actually a movement towards doing more walking therapies.
Yeah.
Without getting into sort of the weeds of that. But what are some of the things that we might be able to do in our work?
Well, one of the things that I started to do is I had patients who were spending almost zero time in nature. And I made contracts with them to reduce their copay if they could come back with time-stamped pictures. our digital pictures have are time stamped from our phones, pictures of themselves in a natural setting. And that actually worked. I had people who cared enough about their copay that they got themselves to nearby parks or nearby forest preserves, got their picture, and got their discount. So, I mean, that's a small thing, but we need programs that are larger than individual practice. And the Europeans are ahead of us. I'm interacting with Kirsten McEwen, who's at the University of Derby, and also with Tamami Shirai, who's affiliated with the American College of Lifestyle Medicine, but also with the Japanese Society of Lifestyle Medicine. We're working on a special issue of the journal, International Journal for Environmental Research and Public Health, special issue on nature contact. Well, Kirsten talks about all of the programs available in the UK. The UK, the healthcare system is not primarily profit motivated.
Right.
So the National Health Service has actually set aside millions of pounds to support what is called green prescribing programs, where the physician actually writes a prescription for the patient to spend time in natural settings. And then the fund pays for education about nature, also for transportation for urban people to get to the natural settings. Now, the Chinese are doing that too, because they actually believe that they are reducing healthcare costs by getting people out into natural areas. So this is happening here and there in the United States, but we need more of that. And one of the obstacles is that our healthcare system is set up on a profit basis.
Right.
So the physicians are incentivized to see more patients per hour, and those that take too much time with their patients are actually penalized. Nevertheless, I worked one day in a community garden up in Muskegon, Michigan, which is affiliated with the Trinity Healthcare System and the local hospitals. And those who work in that community garden, they grow food which is distributed to people who pay a price to subscribe and receive a packet of fresh produce every week. But there are also provisions that physicians can write a prescription getting people a free packet of food to supplement their regular nutrition. And school children are brought in to participate, to in the gardens to be educated about the value of healthy food, nutrition, fresh produce, and also about gardening. So programs like this are often privately funded, so they supplement the healthcare system. But we need more of that.
Do you have any thoughts about how to integrate this or bring this into more mainstream healthcare, at least in the U.S.?
Well, mainstream health care here and there is working on it. There are a number of, and I'll talk about this in my talk as well, there are a number of programs to green the hospital space. I mean, I've got a picture of a Singapore hospital, which you'd think you were in a horticultural center. But there are studies, for example, even just putting a picture of a landscape on the wall, you get better vital signs. When you actually put plants into the ward on the hospital, you get better vital signs, less use of pain medicine, shorter hospital stays, just a variety of objective markers like that. So those things are happening in university health centers. We need them to make it down to the level of the community hospitals, so the places that the average person ends up are affected, not just the major university centers.
Yeah, I sort of want to think a little bit about people in general, because we're fortunate enough to be in spaces that are adjacent to nature or close enough. But what about some of these nature deserts, as you've talked about, say in urban areas or other spaces where people really don't have access? How do we develop this so that it's not just the affluent who have access to this sort of intervention?
Well, one of the movements is the community garden movement, and that takes a lot of different shapes. in some cases, families in urban neighborhoods are given an allotment, a small space that is theirs, that they can come and grow vegetables, grow flowers, herbs, whatever, on their space. The community garden movement also leads to organized shifts for people to work in the community garden and then get some benefit in terms of the work in the garden, but also in terms of sharing some of the produce. So I think we need things like that. In Chicago, some of the vacant lots that have just been derelict have been integrated into community gardens in areas, low-income areas, where there isn't much green space. So you take something that's just an attraction for drug taking or something like that, a derelict space, and you turn it into something positive for the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. But you had also said in hospital studies show that even picture of nature. So I wonder if we can, I mean, it's probably not as good as the real thing, so to speak, but I wonder if there's a role for virtual or...
There is a role. It is clear that even virtual contact with nature is beneficial. The effects aren't as strong, and that may have to do with the biochemical component that isn't there. Maybe we need to learn how to pipe in fight on sides while somebody's viewing the virtual nature scene. I mean, there was a study by Lee et al. Where they actually put people in a hotel room and piped in fight on sides into the air they were breathing in the hotel room. And they got benefit. They got benefit similar to the benefit you get in a green space. So maybe we need to enhance virtual reality with that element, but at least just being in a natural setting. Now, what the natural setting is makes a difference. There were some attempts at underwater scenes, and they induced panic attack in some people. So we have to be careful what we do in that virtual nature. But yes, that's worthwhile because we can't get everybody into an actual green space. Mm-hmm. Although I have to say, people in a wheelchair, for example, more and more of our green spaces are handicapped accessible. Mm-hmm. I can remember 30 years ago hiking in northern Michigan near Lake Superior with my wife, and we stumbled across a parallel path that was wheelchair accessible. And I thought, why is that there? I mean, are people with wheelchairs going to come in the forest? Yes, they are. And they do now.
Right.
And many of, I know in West Michigan, where I live, many of our natural areas have wheelchair accessible paths. So we have to do things like that so that people with limited mobility can get there. We have to find ways to get people with limited income for transportation to get there. And then we have to do education and motivation. I've got a picture in my lecture of a group of young people sitting on a stoop looking at their screens.
Right.
I grew up breathing the forest. If I'd had an iPad and a smartphone, maybe I wouldn't have. Maybe I would have sat mm-hmm. home and read things and been entertained by my screen. There is a danger there. That some of the addictive activities that we've created in our culture take people and isolate them from one another, but also from nature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it hasn't created the problem, but it certainly contributed to it. I mean, I think sort of
yes.
urbanization and industrialization of nature and of farming has probably started that.
And that's global. I mean, that's one
yeah.
thing I always like to remind people. This is not just an affluent country problem. The Western lifestyle with unhealthy food, sedentary life, urban living is everywhere. The megalopolises, the largest ones, are actually in places like India with 25 million to 30 million people clustered
right.
in a city. If we have a problem with nature deserts, they have bigger problems with nature deserts. And people are moving. I talked with public health nurses. I had a program going on in Jamaica many years ago, supplementing a health center in a small area called Trelawney Parish in Jamaica near Montego Bay, and I talked to the public health nurses, and they had a problem already, and this was maybe 30 years ago, actually, when I think about it. They had people moving out of the hills, away from family, to take jobs in the harbor area of Montego Bay, because there were tax-free zones where large companies could bring in cloth and pay Jamaicans to assemble the cloth into clothing. And the workers there, they were attracted by well-paying jobs, but they had all of the health problems of people in an American city. They had increased heart disease, high stress, emotional disorders, a lot of what we would call psychosomatic or functional problems, and chronic diseases, diabetes, heart disease, and so on. And that was 20, 30 years ago. It's worse now, and it's everywhere.
Well, given that all that context, and you know, as we sort of come to the close of our chat, if someone was listening and wanted to make an easy improvement, so to speak, what sort of advice would you give them?
I would say begin with oneself. We have to walk the talk, and I believe, have always believed, if I'm going to be doing biofeedback, I better have good control of my own physiology. I've had more than one child say, yeah, but can you do it? And then I would warm my hands to 96 right. degrees, and then they would say, oh, wow, you can do it. I can do it then. I think we need to do the same thing with nature. Mm-hmm. You know, ask myself, how many minutes a week am I actually spending in nature? Mm-hmm. Just like how many minutes a week am I moving? How many minutes a week am I walking? If we find ways to build nature contact into our own lifestyle, that's a beginning. And then we can at least ask the question, when was the last time that you were in a natural setting, doing something, taking a walk, sitting and meditating in a natural setting, in a park, in a forest, at the beach? My friend Tamami Shirai always reminds me, what about the natural space around a body of water? There may or may not be phytoncides, but there's clearly a benefit of sitting by a river and enjoying the tranquility of that river cascading down river. So, yeah, then we can start raising the question with our patients. And when we do lifestyle assessment, that should be one of the questions. How many minutes a week do you spend in nature? And how could you increase that?
Well, my guest today was Dr. Don Moss, Dean Emeritus at the College of Integrative Medicine and Health Sciences at Saybrook University, and an expert in biofeedback, hypnosis, and psychophysiology. You can hear more from Don and our other presenters at this year's NRBS conference. We're meeting virtually, so you can join us from anywhere. September 26th and the 27th, go to nrbs.org or the conference link in the show notes. Now, if you register before August 15th, there are early bird discounts, and you can get an extra special additional 10% discount by using the code NRBS26INVITE. So join us at the end of September and, of course, on our next episode of Healthy Brain, Happy Body. Don, thank you so much for joining us today.
Happy to be here. Thank you for including me, Saul. Just writing down the special code.
Everyone else should use it too.
Take care.
Thanks for joining us on Healthy Brain, Happy Body. Subscribe to this podcast by clicking the subscribe here link in the show notes or wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoy Healthy Brain, Happy Body, please rate us and leave reviews at Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or wherever you get the podcast. Reviews help us reach more listeners, and that's more people who can learn about and benefit from biofeedback, neurofeedback, and other mind-body approaches to health. Also, let us know what you think by sending us email. Our address is healthybrain@nrbs.org. Healthy Brain, Happy Body is produced and edited by me. The theme music is Catch It by Coma Media. It is a production of the Northeast Region Biofeedback Society. Go to nrbs.org to find out more about the organization, including our trainings, monthly webinars, and yearly conference. All opinions expressed are those of our guests and not the NRBS. This podcast is not meant to replace advice from qualified healthcare providers. Healthy Brain, Happy Body is supported by the sponsors of NRBS. Be sure to join us on our next episode as we continue to explore the keys to our well-being,
on Healthy Brain, Happy Body.